Have you listened to any episodes yet?
Man, you're going to hate me when I say no, I haven't.
No, no, I will not hate you because it's fine. Don't worry about it. Not offended at all, jerk. Interview over.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
I am being realistic.
As the story grows.
Hey, welcome back to As the Story Grows. My name is Trav, and tonight I'm going to be talking to legendary Christian metal vocalist of Becoming the Archetype, Jason Wisdom. Jason, how the heck are you doing?
Doing awesome, man. Thanks for having me.
Legendary. I mean,
I'm not sure that that's accurate, but that's okay.
I feel weird calling anybody legendary that's actually slept on the floor in my daughter's room. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'll take the upgrade. Legendary status.
No problem at all.
I just leveled up.
I can kiss your butt for a minute because I know you, and I'm going to make you feel uncomfortable, but you have one of my favorite style of metal voices because it's brutal, it's throaty, it's nasty, it definitely sours the stomach, but I can understand every word you say. You know, awesome. When I was in Alathian, I was like, phew, man, Joel could be up there reading the recipe to chicken Kiev. I have no idea what the dude is saying. You know what I mean? that kind of a weird death metal voice. I was like, kids dig it. That's cool. I can't understand what he's saying, but I've always been able to distinguish what you were saying. You and Chris McCadden,
yeah,
from
Embodiment.
Embodiment and Famine, yeah. just got that style of voice where I'm like, oh, okay, I understand what they're saying now. So kudos, excellent, beautiful singing voice that you've been gifted with.
Thanks, man. That's not what my mom thinks, but I'm glad you think so.
Yeah, my mom asked me one time when I was going to start taking music seriously and playing good stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My mom, believe it or not, it's a funny story. My mom and my dad actually saw me play music for the very first time this past Easter. So just a few months ago was the first time either one of them had ever seen me with an instrument in my hands. So
you're kidding.
That was playing at Easter service at church. So 4 or 5 years after I left Becoming the Archetype, my parents saw me play music for the first time.
Were they big fans of Becoming the Archetype when you guys were cranking out albums?
I think their coping mechanism for the fact that I had quit college after 2 years rather than continuing on, which is what they wanted for me. I think their coping mechanism for not being terribly disappointed in me was to just sort of pretend it wasn't happening. So I don't think they were fans of Becoming the Archetype. I think they prefer to think that, you know, that 5 or 6 years didn't happen.
Like a prodigal son thing going. Like he went off and he's like his clothes are rags and he's eating swill with the pigs and everything, but oh, he's coming back now. Cool. Everything's all right. We'll just pretend none of that ever happened. Come on in for dinner, you know?
Yeah. I'm not sure about that. I'm always kind of doing something new, it seems like, that they're confused with, or which we can get into that. But I became a teacher for a few years, and I think that was sort of like their, okay, finally, our prodigal son's come home. And then I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to become a missionary now to the music industry. And they're like, wait, what does that mean? How are you gonna get money? And I'm like, well, you know, the way missionaries get money, you know, we'll raise donations. And they're like, oh, Jason, you have a family. Come on. So anyway.
Yeah, I definitely want to get into that, because as of the beginning of us saying hi, welcome to As the Story Grows, I thought you were still a teacher. So we'll get there. We'll step through it and everything, yep. But we're going to circle around to that because Jason Wisdom was once in the music industry, and now he is going to be a missionary to go back and try to help the music industry. So yep. that's a full circle thing going. Man, this podcast actually sounds like we know what we're doing sometimes. So
yeah, there you go.
All right. So like everybody says, that generic thing, let's start at the beginning. Jason Wisdom. What kind of name is – I've never heard of such a cool last name.
I don't know, man. Yeah. I'm not exactly sure. I think that everybody who lives in the Southeast claims to have a little bit of Native American heritage somewhere a little back down the line. So I heard once upon a time, I think, that it has Cherokee roots.
Okay.
But I don't know, because there are people that I find – on the internet all the time that are all over the country. There's actually, my neighbors asked me to mow their yard one time, and I said, here's my email address, and it's got my name with my middle initial in it, and they left out the middle initial, so they just sent it to jasonwisdom@whateverTheAddress.com.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that that's some guy in New York City, and so the guy was like, well, hey, I live at, you know, like the 15th floor of a apartment building, but if you want me to mow your grass, I'll do the best I can. So... He was a funny guy, but there's apparently several Jason Wisdoms out there, so it's not as unique as it might seem.
It's an exclusive club.
Yeah.
Okay, so you might be Indian. We got that down. Native American Indian.
I don't think I have any sort of that showing up in my in my physical appearance, though.
No, you don't. I never. Nah. When I first saw you, I was like, Not Native American is not what popped in my head.
Yeah, my mother's maiden name was McWilliams, and I think some more of that's coming through. The ginger beard and the...
There you go. Now we're talking.
Now, yeah. And the can't walk out in the sun without turning red instantly.
I've got the same affliction. My great-grandmother off the boat was a Finnegan. So, yeah, I'm designed for a... I have skin like onion paper. It just goes up.
There you go.
Or flash paper, I think I meant. Whatever. Whichever line is funnier. Pick that one and edit the other one out. Okay, so Christian kid growing up in a Christian home, and you fell into this crazy heavy music. I'm going to take a wild guess. When I first met you, your email address had something to do with post-momentary affliction. I'm going to take a stab at it that you were a Mortification fan. Yes, no?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, all right.
I had forgotten about that. Email address. I actually am sitting here on the couch in my office room, and I have a Mortification pillow on my couch that's made out of an old Mortification t-shirt. So
that's awesome. What's on? Yeah. What shirt?
It's a... Hold on. Let's see. Envision Evangeline.
Oh, shirt. That makes sense.
Yep, and then I've got a tourniquet pillow for pathogenic ocular dissonance, and a No Innocent Victim pillow.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Yeah, my wife just took all of my old band t-shirts and made them into pillows.
Oh, what a great idea.
So to all the dudes out there who have wives now who are like, you can't wear that stupid band t-shirt anymore. Now, that's an idea of what you can do with them. Turn them into pillows.
I have and ugly as sin, stained with a small hole in it, banana yellow Dillinger Escape Plan t-shirt. It's too small for me, and my belly's gotten a little bit bigger. My wife hates that shirt. I put it on. I'm like, what's up, honey, old Yeller? And she's like, I hate that shirt. I'm going to rip it off. I'm going to throw it in the garbage when you're not looking. And I don't know. She threatens. She's never actually done it, but it is disgusting. We make a rad pillow. I should mail it to your wife.
There you go.
Yeah, good idea. Okay, for all the listeners, mail your t-shirts straight to Jason Wisdom's house, and your wife will turn them into pillows for you.
Yeah.
No, don't do that. I'm just kidding. So, where did this all get started for you with the heavy stuff and starting to play bass with a heavy band? And you said your parents were a little bit on the outs when it came to that kind of stuff. So, where did it all start for you?
Yeah. So, I kind of fell into the band by accident, I guess. I didn't necessarily go searching for a band to play in or anything like that, and I really hadn't listened to a whole lot of heavy music. I grew up just listening to whatever my parents listened to, which for the most part was country music because we always lived in the South. And mm-hmm. I remember I moved to Virginia at one point in middle school, and some kids, I guess this was like a 90s thing for the middle school kids, they were like, hey man, what kind of music do you listen to? And that was the way they were going to figure out if I was cool or not.
Right.
And I was like, I don't know, whatever, country. And they were like, oh, you're a loser. Have you ever listened to Green Day? And you know, that's when Green Day was new. Anyway, so I was a loser. But so I guess what I'm saying is I wasn't seeking out. I wasn't like a raging metalhead just dying to be in a band. I just had some friends that played instruments. Brent Duckett, otherwise known as Duck.
Ducky.
And Sean Cunningham and John Starr and some other guys. And they were just getting together in Brent's basement and
playing. Sean Cunningham was the original fifth member, right?
Yeah, the original third guitar player, yeah.
Got it.
And just playing stuff in their basement. For the most part, it was like covering Living Sacrifice songs, covering old Zao songs and things like that. And the music that I was listening to at the time was like Five Iron Frenzy and MXPX and Supertones and stuff like that. So I was definitely not a metal kid, but then they were going to go play a Battle of the Bands or something at a local high school.
Mm-hmm.
And before it was cool to have two vocalists in the band, I just kind of was like, hey, well, I could be a vocalist, you know. So then we had two vocalists. The other guy eventually quit randomly, and so I ended up being I ended up even being in a band. Prior to that, I was just sitting in their basement listening to them play songs. And then the bass player guy who was playing for us quit at one point. Then another bass player guy joined, and then he moved to Indiana to get married, and then I just was like, well, I guess I could maybe do both. So I picked up a bass that belonged to Brent's girlfriend at the time because I didn't have a bass. I mean, this is the long version, but that I guess what I'm wanting to convey is that it all happened kind of by accident, but it kind of came naturally.
Were you playing music at that point?
No.
So you picked up a bass guitar to be the bassist of Becoming the Archetype? You're kidding me.
Yeah, and well, we weren't Becoming the Archetype yet. We were the band that would become Becoming the Archetype.
Right, Becoming the Archetype.
Yeah, Becoming the Archetype. But
it doesn't fit on a shirt, or on the pillow would look terrible, but...
No. But, no, I just picked it up and was more or less like, okay, well, where do I, you know, which frets do I push down and stuff like that.
You're kidding me, really?
And I wrote an extensive article on it for my blog at becauseitstrue.com recently explaining how, you know, for 10 years I was playing a bass guitar, and I can't really ever say I learned how to play the bass guitar. I just kind of knew where to put my fingers on the frets to play the songs that BTA was playing. you know, and so then if anybody would ever been like, hey, play this riff or whatever, I'd have been like, I don't know. Or then when I went to church the first time to play in the church band, and they were like, okay, so this song's GCD. That's pretty easy. Everybody knows GCD, right? Okay, here we go. And I'm like, wait, where's G? You know, and I've been a professional bassist for, you know, 10 years. So
they're all lies.
Yeah, but it all, it all came together, and I've
that's kind of amazing. I mean, it's not that you were faking it or didn't know what you were doing and everything, but I mean, no one, I don't think anyone ever walked out of a BTA show and was like, "Your bass player doesn't even know what he's doing, dude." You held up fine, but you.
Oh no! Listen, I won the best.
You literally didn't even know what you were doing.
I won the best bass player award for HM Magazine like 2 years in a row, which is awesome, and I feel really bad for all the legitimate bass players that I beat.
Yeah, really.
But I've since learned how to play the bass guitar. But anyway,
good.
Yeah, but
you should join a band. You'd probably be half decent.
Yeah, it's not like I didn't know how to play. It's just I didn't. The analogy I used in my article that I wrote was, it's kind of like a lot of people live their lives, like they live their Christian lives even, is like they just sort of go on autopilot, and it's like they think they already know all they need to know, but they never really actually dig down and put the pieces together. And so I kind of knew everything I needed to know to play the BTA songs. I was pretty darn good at playing those songs, but I never put the pieces together to be able to play anything else. I knew how to play Chick Magnet by MXPX, and that was about it. So, and I only knew the first part of that song. So if you ever find an old video of us sound checking, you'll notice that I quit as soon as I got past the first riff.
Very interesting. I did not know that about you.
It's really embarrassing. So there you go. You win.
Best bass player of the year, 2 years in a row. Dude didn't even know how to play Chick Magnet.
Yeah, but I was more focused on writing lyrics and doing vocals.
Right.
So the bass thing was just like a thing to do. So.
And I think I mentioned this in the Seth episode. We talked to Seth Hecox on Chapter 6. I think the breakdown with the Make My Life Your Own, I think that's still the one riff out of all the breakdowns, because there's so many of them. Everybody's got breakdowns upon breakdowns. And
right.
That's the one riff. I wouldn't stand near me when it comes on, because I tend to start bouncing around a little bit. I mean, I'm a grown man. I'm trying to behave myself. I pull muscles easier now and everything. But once that once that part starts up, I'll still windmill a little. It was awesome. Great job. Who wrote that? Was that you?
The breakdown, probably, because it doesn't have any musical anything. It's just rhythmic.
It's just chunky peanut butter. Can't go wrong with that.
So yeah, which is the other weird part of this story, because when I tell people this story about how I didn't play the bass, or you know, I didn't know what I was doing, they'll go, "Oh, okay, so I guess you never wrote any of the music." And I'm like, "No, I wrote lots of the music." And they're like, "What do you mean you wrote the music?" And I'm like, "Oh, I would just sit down with John, the guitar player, or Seth, or whoever, and be like, "Hey, man, I got an idea for a riff. It goes bugga 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 digga digga bugga 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 digga digga," you know, and that's how we would write riffs. And not all the time. For the most part, the guitar players were writing the riffs,
right?
But there were at least a couple or three songs per record, and a few riffs sparse, you know, thrown in here and there that were my riffs. And I think that was one of those rhythms that I was like, "Oh, this would be a cool rhythm."
Surround yourself with greatness. So you guys always had legit guitar players. Seth is no joke. John, Alex, you know, came in there for a while.
Yep. Daniel Gailey.
Daniel, yeah. I mean, I met Daniel. He was the last version of BTA to spend the night at our house. And he plays in
a really good band named Phineas.
Yep.
That's just put out a new record.
Just came out. Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm gonna include a link in there because I'm hearing good stuff about it.
Yep.
Yeah, go Daniel. And yeah, that's pretty funny. That's interesting that I do it too. I, as a drummer, I try to tell a guitarist, like, well, that part that you're going me, maybe do the and I just kind of jibber jabber my way through it. And as long as you kind of coherently mix a little bit,
man, that sucks. You're not musical at all.
Me?
Yeah, it sucks, man. I wish you knew more music. I hate it for you, man.
Yeah, what are you gonna do?
Yeah.
Okay, so
that's how I got in BTA. Yep.
So then BTA found Solid State. Solid State found BTA.
Yeah, it was more like Solid State found BTA. We were playing at Cornerstone Festival, whoop whoop, in Illinois, which was awesome. And we were playing. We were playing on a. I guess it was maybe it was the impromptu stage where you had to sign up and get your name pulled out of a hat. And of all the years that we played concerts, there was only one time in all of that that I lost my voice. That might be surprising since I scream my guts out every night, but there was only one time I lost my voice, and it was before we played at the impromptu tent at Cornerstone, and that was the concert that got us signed. So I can't take any credit for getting us signed because I couldn't scream, and I'm obviously not a bass player, so it was all the rest of the guys in the band at the time. But we, yeah,
dude,
the guys.
What is with you? You don't know how to play bass, and you couldn't even sing the night you guys got signed. Man, you're like the weakest link in that band.
Yeah, I'm awful. So like the guys from Demon Hunter came walking by our tent, and liked what they heard, and we're like, hey, do you guys have any demo stuff? And we were like, sure. We gave them our demo stuff, and they were like, yeah, this isn't really good. Do you have any new songs you're working on? Can you go record those? So we ran into the studio and recorded some new demo stuff and sent it to them, and they're like, hey, you guys really need to change your name. Because we were called The Remnant at that time.
Okay.
And there was a punk band called The Remnants that was around, and they were like, you need to change your name. We were like, okay, I'll change our name. So I can remember going and sitting on Duck's computer and going on, like, Microsoft Paint or whatever it was, and, like, making this ridiculously awful-looking font and typing Becoming the Archetype, because I was like, okay, I got to like make it look cool before I show them what the name is.
Right.
Because if I just say Becoming the Archetype, they're going to go, what, that's dumb. But if I like make it look cool and metal, then they'll love it. So I printed it off from like Microsoft Paint and walked into the living room and was like, hey, what do you think of this name? And they were like, what does that mean? And that kind of became a thing almost that I did, naming songs and stuff like that, picking weird words, and people learned a lot of vocabulary from Becoming the Archetype.
Yeah, it's got some heady stuff to it.
So there you go.
Definitely worth a read. Yeah.
Yeah. I just really liked the three word name. Like Training for Utopia was probably one of my favorite band names.
Oh, sure. Okay.
And I was like, man, such a cool name. I want a name like that. So
right.
Becoming the Archetype. There it was. And then we got signed from that demo. It was pretty cool. And we went out on tour not long after we got signed with Showbread and The Showdown and Mortal Treason, and a band that joined us partly on that was called Point Zero, who some people will know later became the band War of Ages.
Oh yeah,
I've heard of War of Ages, which is still around. They've put out like 7 records on Face Down, and I went and watched one of their YouTube videos the other day. It's got 1 million plays. I was like, what?
Wow.
So those guys, you mean those guys we played with like 2004? So yeah. Anyway, that's how we got going.
Cool. I met you guys right around is it 05 that Alex joined up?
Alex was 06-ish because John left after we recorded Terminate Damnation in 04-05.
Yeah,
so it's probably 06 when we went out with Demon Hunter.
Okay.
Alex joined.
At that point, I had left Crutch, then changed their name to Alethean. I had left early 2003, but I'm still in touch with, you know, my friends and stuff like that. And I caught wind that he was like, he was going to two time and he was going to do Alethean and Becoming the Archetype. And I was like, dude, they live in Georgia. How are you going to do that?
Yeah.
And he was the first one that kind of indoctrinated me into, well, you know, you don't all have to be standing in the room to write music together, dummy. You know? And I was like,
yeah, that's interesting that you put it that way. I haven't ever thought about how, in 2006 or whatever that was really radical. And here we are now, it's 2015, and I mean, that band that Daniel's playing in, Phineas, I was asking them at the festival I saw them, I was like, so where do you guys all live? And one of the guys lives in Iowa, I think, and one of the guys lives in L.A., and one of the guys, and Daniel lives in Atlanta, and I was like, gosh, what is going on? I think that's more normal now. So,
yeah. Alex was always ahead of the curve with that kind of stuff, because he would write riffs. The Alethean album, Dying Vine, has 3 songs on it that I was playing live, and the drums that Joe played on that album were pretty much mostly what I wrote. And he did his own thing, and he did a great job. But those songs were written by Alex, writing riffs, burning them onto a CD, CDR. But yeah. This is 01, back when CD burners were the size of your, you know, the chest of drawers you put your clothes in. You know what I mean?
Right.
And he'd give me a CD, and I would go home and copy it onto a cassette and play it in the tape deck of my delivery truck. And I would write like I would write my polyrhythm stuff down on the back of a ticket. Like the back of, you know, I had to print out all the tickets and not all the customers wanted them. I'd flip over delivery tickets and be like, that's in 13. That's in, but, and I'd hash out music while I'm making deliveries from a cassette tape that he burned on. And he lived in Philly and I lived up here. And it was, in my opinion, pioneering. Cause at that time everybody else was like, well, if he doesn't show up for practice that week, he doesn't.
Right.
Yeah. He's down a week, you know? And here we were like corresponding. Practically, right. Mailing me stuff. You know, it was pretty neat, pretty cool.
Which is the norm now, because everybody just does everything through email.
Well, look at Solomors. we never even saw each other the entire time, you know.
Which we need to do. We should figure out a way to play like a show, a festival or something. It'd be fun.
Talk to Alex.
Yeah, we'll do it.
I'll do it. I don't care. But anyway, so he joined on and ran around with Alathian and Crimson Moonlight.
Yep, Crimson Moonlight.
Right, and then in 2008, I got the call if I wanted to go record Dichotomy with Devin Townsend in Canada, and I was like, of course, the response was like, yeah, hell yeah, I do. That sounds great. And then like 20 minutes after hanging up the phone, I was like, oh, wait a minute, I got Devin Townsend. Like I started wrapping my head around it. And I got scared and freaked out and everything. And it turned out that it didn't work out for me anyway. And you guys picked up Brandon. But, wow. Tell me. I mean, bummer that I couldn't do it. But also, hey, if it wasn't in the cards, it's not in the cards. I'm not that guy. Whatever. I'm glad Brandon got the opportunity. What was it like to work with Devin Townsend?
It was awesome. And to this day, I mean, it's hard for me to it's hard for me to overstate how much of an impact he had on me from the aspect of, I mean, just everything, music, the way he approached things. I mean, I'll probably never record anything as long as I live that I won't be thinking, well, what would Devin do here? Like, what,
wow, okay.
How would Devin make this better? Because I mean, that even if you hated our band, you really like listen to the Dichotomy record, and it's just it's a masterwork of production. I mean,
superb.
What he does on that record from a production standpoint is insane. Mm-hmm. It's like if all of our records had that production, oh my gosh! I mean, people would have thought we were the greatest band to ever live. I mean, you know what I mean? It's Devin has that. He's just got that master touch. I'm not saying that he's faking it, because the man's a genius musically anyway. Just seeing him sit in the room with a guitar in his hand and just kind of noodling around, you're like, wow, I'm in the presence of somebody who's just beyond amazing at what he does.
I wouldn't take it as faking it at all, but I mean, these guys that were in bands that have become producers have their they have their thing. I guess this is officially every chapter that we've done that I'm going to mention Jay Robbins, the guy from Jawbox. Go get an album produced by Jay Robbins. It isn't him, but it is. You know what I mean?
Right.
Kurt from Converge up there in God City. That's just you come out of God City with that particular sound, you know? And Devin has forged himself some sort of ethereal. I can't describe.
Right.
All I know is when I heard Dichotomy, I was like, damn.
Somebody would have to do the research on this, but I can't tell you what he's produced after Dichotomy other than his own stuff. I know I think there might have been one or two more records, but he went through a patch where he stepped away from Strapping Young Lad.
Mm-hmm.
And he sobered up, got his life together, and I think he went the opposite direction, which is, okay, if heavy metal music is tied to anger and evil and drugs and all this other kind of stuff, I need to leave that behind. Mm-hmm. And so we were with him in the studio while he was processing through a lot of that, which was really interesting because we roll in as a Christian band wanting to play brutal, heavy music, and one of the first questions he had was, how does that work? How can you be Christians?
Does not compute.
Yeah, because in his mind, heavy metal equals drugs and chaos. And if you ever listen to Strapping Young Lad, then you understand that's basically all they were doing was just channeling anger and chaos.
Yeah, yeah.
And I definitely don't think this is real in any way. But there's a part of me that, because I love the music he makes now, and he's gone back to making heavy music, but if you listen to it, it's more positive. It's mm-hmm. more uplifting. The way it even sounds is more positive, and there's a lot of that that kind of comes through on the Dichotomy record at times that he influenced, and I'm not trying to say we influenced him back,
right?
But I like to think that there was something going on there in our relationship with him that he was processing through that at the time, and he kind of came out of that record going, okay, maybe it is possible to be positive and make heavy music.
I love it. You had to have influenced him, because if he approached you with, okay, how does this work, and you answered him with Dichotomy, I'm not saying that he sat down and went, okay, Becoming the Archetype just bent my brain and things are different now. But I mean, if he had a question and you answer it, that's an influenced.
Well,
you know what I mean? Like, that's, you know.
We spent a lot of time talking about it while we were in the studio, and so a lot of the views I hold on that kind of stuff, even to this day, came from him, which is, you know, so if somebody were to ask me, and I've written about this on my website as well, if somebody were to ask me, well, the question that, you know, Christian youth group kids ask all the time, is it okay for Christians to play heavy metal or to listen to heavy metal? I mean, it's like a youth group question if there ever was one.
Right.
And it's like, oh, come on, that's so immature. But at the same time, if you're 15 years old and you're asking that question, you know, you just want to rebel and you're mad at your parents or whatever, or maybe you're not and you just like that kind of music, the answer I give people a lot of times now kind of really comes from what Devin talked with us about, which is like, you know, I mean, music's a powerful thing, heavy music even more so, and you just kind of got to be careful with what you're doing and know what you're doing. Yeah. Devin was serious about that, and that's coming from a guy who's not a Christian, but he's a spiritual guy. He believes mm-hmm. in spirituality. He's just not mm-hmm. a Christian. So, I valued his take on that, which is like, hey, you guys are dabbling some dangerous territory here, playing this incredibly aggressive music that's going to stir people up. Are you sure you know what you're doing? So that was a good challenge for me. And so I tell a lot of people sometimes if they ask, oh, my kids are involved and they listen to heavy metal music, they love it, I'm scared about it. I'm like, well, you just need to sit down and talk with them and make sure they got, you know, a good head on their shoulders and they're not doing it just to sort of be pissed at the world and pissed at God. Because, I mean, that's kind of probably normal for a certain age group. But if they keep doing that, you know, they're 28 years old, 30 years old, they're still living in their parents' basement, they're just pissed at the world, and,
right,
you know what I mean? Then they probably got a problem, and they probably need to listen to something else for a little while and chill out. But I saw a study the other day, I don't know if you saw this, I saw a study that said that heavy music actually has been proven to make people more calm. Did you see that?
No, I thought for sure you were going to say that heavy metal attracts sharks. I saw that on Twitter, and I
really
I read three paragraphs and I started giggling, and I was like, okay, I have better things to do. But
You need to do a podcast on that. I saw they were saying there's a psychological study they did that showed that listening to heavy music makes people more calm, actually, as a result. So
not the breakdown in Epigon.
No, certainly not.
Oh, I think I said Elegy before, didn't I? Whatever, yeah. You know what I mean. They all start with it. Yeah, that's what you get for making all your fancy words. Yeah. I liken it to this. When I was a kid, I was I got super into the Police. They're my favorite rock band ever. And I bought the box set, and I was reading up on a statement that Sting made, and he said, I was there. I remember the Sex Pistols. I remember the frustration with Parliament and how angry and pissed off everybody was. I understand. I was there. I saw it. I'm with you. I feel the same way. But there's just something about me. I'm just not pissed about it. and I was like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Like, I get it too. Growing up in a Christian home, listening to this kind of music and everything, the aggression and the pissed offness, which isn't a word, but I'm going to use it now, it comes from frustration. It comes from I'm just going to yell louder because I don't feel like right. You're listening to me. And this is to get your attention, because I know it's like Alan talked about with the Scattered Few stuff. The bands that were out there at the time when they were putting up God Rules and everything, that's it's just not reaching the crowd that he was trying to reach, you know? I fell in with the heaviest stuff early on because they were, you know, Vengeance and Believer and stuff like that. Believer went on tour with Bolt Thrower. They weren't playing youth groups. I'm sure they played some to get started, but that wasn't the point. The point was, hey, we're legitimate too, you know? Right. And I hear what you're saying about music, and in my opinion, I mean, this whole interview and episode is supposed to be about you, but now that we're talking about it and we have it out here in the open, I think subtleties come in pop music. Because you're trying to get everybody into it. Pop is short for popular, right? So I'm trying to sneak my if I have something to say, I have to be very careful on how I get it in there, because I got to move units. I got to sell records. Whereas what I always liked about metal was like, here you go. I mean, you already know what you're getting into. The drums are loud. The guitars are fast. The dude's screaming.
Right.
If you don't like this kind of stuff, you're not here anyway.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to lay out my message, and it could be everything from yay Satan to yay Jesus. And, or sometimes you get like those tech bands that are just singing about dragons or what, I don't know, whatever. Right. But the point is there are no punches to be pulled here. It's a very dynamic thing. We can go all the way from classical strings all the way up to grind, and it's right. All in the same song. And we're just going to drop it right there, and if you're not into it, walk away. Pop music, I think, is where you have to get almost sneaky, you know?
Right. That was my draw to the music, because, like I said, I didn't grow up looking for an outlet to be angry or whatever, so it's odd that I end up being the guy in front screaming
right.
at people, because I wasn't angry about anything.
right.
At all. I played golf in high school. I still play golf when I can. It's expensive, but I like golf.
You're a very good golfer, aren't you?
Once upon a time, I was a pretty darn good golfer, and I can hold my own.
Okay.
I'm better than Tiger Woods, because he's awful now. But anyway, there's just a few golf people that will get that. But anyway, here's my point. I was drawn to the heavy music because of some of the things you're talking about, which is, to me, it was almost like the current day version of, like, you know, the classical music. Like, you could do anything. You could have any sort of mood. It could get really loud. It could get really chaotic. It could get really dissonant. It could get crazy. The time signatures could change all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And all this other kind of stuff. The musicianship was at its highest level. That's what drew me into it. It mm-hmm. wasn't the anger or the frustration. It was the musicianship. Of course, I wasn't a part of that at all, because I didn't know how to play my instrument. I'm really beating up on myself too much with that, because I kind of knew a little bit about what's going on. I took music theory courses in college, so I knew what I was doing. I just hadn't put the pieces together.
Okay.
But anyhow, my point is, so to this day, I'm still a geek for prog rock and really technical metal and things like that. I mean, not because I'm angry or because I just love to hear, you know, big burly men gurgle and growl and stuff, but because I want to see guitar players and drummers and bassists that are just, man, they're just top notch and they know what they're doing. So
top of their game. I couldn't agree more. I mean, I'm not saying that a great rock band isn't a great rock band. They are what they are, but I'm not watching a drummer push himself to the absolute limits. They never have. Again, here we go with sneaking things into pop music.
Right.
Like Dave Weckl, one of my most influential, one of the most influential drummers I've ever heard. I have every solo thing the man's ever done. He's an amazing, untouchable drummer. The dude had to pay bills. He played Madonna songs. He played on pop albums. It was just, and he was like, I gotta buy groceries. You know what I mean? So the man is possible. The man's capable of blowing your mind, but. Right. Here's what I got to do. So I got to make the masses enjoy this. So we're going to, you know, with all the respect to pop fans, dumb it down. We have to make it popular so everybody can relate with it. And it's easy. And the lyrics are kind of shallow. And it is what it is. And then it becomes a huge hit. And it's popular. And these people are on television. They're touring around the country with one hit. And I always felt like I'm just not watching the best that person has to offer.
Yeah.
Metal bands are like, dude, I mean,
that's what happened with Crutch, right? You guys had that one big hit and, no?
What? big hit? No.
That's where you get all the money to do this podcast from, right?
That's how I bought the house. Sure, sure. It was,
the Crutch money.
When All in Disbelief went up the charts. Yeah.
Awesome.
Shut up. But, no, it was just like when that metal band drags their half-dead carcasses off stage and I know that they gave me their everything, I feel like, whew, okay, I accept that. You know what I mean? Whereas I just feel like a lot of the show is posturing and stuff and dressing a certain way and looking a certain way. Dude, I'm not into that at all. I never have been. I'm not sure I ever will be. I'm not saying I can't appreciate how awesome a stage show looks and how I'm sure Justin Timberlake puts on an amazing show, but it's not for me. You know, you know. Right. Anyway, we're way off topic. Who the hell cares what I think? That's cool. Thank you for talking about Devin Townsend. I actually never ever spoke to you about that. I always wanted to hear about how it went, and that's neat. That's cool that maybe you kind of got in each other's heads. And I mean, that's the whole point. We're all doing this, right? Yeah. The whole point I'm talking to you is because I'm hoping somebody hears this and goes, "Wow, that's influential. I'm going to click on that link and look into that." And so, you know, we're all just spreading each other's stories around. That's, you know. Anyway, fast forward a little bit and did a little bit more with BTA, then did a little bit more with BTA, and then it came time to call quits and rein it in and go home and have kids, right? Something like that?
Right. Yeah. So I did 4 studio albums with BTA and lots of tours. We did tours, I think I did 2 tours in Europe and a tour in South Africa and a tour, not a tour, but played some shows in Mexico and some shows in Canada. And
it's amazing.
I mean, it's just awesome. I mean, honestly, when people have asked me, what's the best tour you've ever done? Where were you most received or where'd you have the most fun? That tour in South Africa was the most fun. And there's a whole podcast worth of stuff to talk about why it was so much fun. It had to do with the fact that their music scene is not so oversaturated like ours is. So those people were just stoked to have a band, a live band, come in and play. I mean, there'd be 600 people show up for an outdoor show on a weekday just to watch us play, and they're like, they don't know who we are. They don't know who we are. They're just there to hang out and have fun and listen to music.
Well, you can talk about it a little bit. Tell us what it was like.
No, I mean, yeah, that's what it was like. We would show up these places, and we're like, we don't know these people, and they don't have our CDs because they weren't distributed down there. I think one of them was distributed down there, but they, you know, for the most part, we're just a band from somewhere else, and they were like, oh, man, cool music, an American band. All right, let's go hear it. So, I mean, some of the most fun shows I ever played in my life were there. We played one outdoor show there, which I think there's a video I saw the other day on YouTube. Some guy filmed the whole thing. I mean, the show was so much of a blast that at the end of the set we all like simultaneously dove off the stage, crowd surfed at the same time, including Duck, the drummer. And then they brought us all back up onto the stage, and then we played another song. I mean, it was that kind of show that was just so much fun. I remember at one point, Duck, our drummer, stage dove by himself. They carried him all the way back to the sound booth at the back, and then brought him all the way back, like high five the sound guy, and everybody was cheering the whole time. The only thing we didn't do, which I would really love to see some band do now, but I wouldn't want to be the guy doing this. I would love to see somebody stage dive, like a guitar player with a wireless, stage dive on his back, and then get carried around a circle pit. Like, so the circle pit's going around, and he's like bouncing on the top of the circle pit while he's going around playing his guitar. Now that would be fun.
Probably be fun to watch, but
when
that guy falls, breaks his arm, and smashes his guitar, and then you have to drive 14 hours to the next show, you're not going to be happy about it.
Yeah, it'd be pretty scary. But but anyway, so my point is that, you know, we did lots of fun stuff. That the Mexico shows that we played were the last ones I did. We were in the studio recording Celestial Completion in 2010, 2011-ish, I guess, whatever it was. And we found out that we were pregnant, that my wife was pregnant. We were going to have, I don't know why people say we were pregnant. She was pregnant, but.
Yeah, I didn't have much to do with my wife's pregnancy.
Yeah, you know what I mean, though. It's just a thing. It's a thing people say when we were pregnant.
We were pregnant, right. Yeah. We had a baby. I didn't. Yeah. Well, I just stood there and went, oh, my God, are you okay? And yeah, tried not to throw up. You know.
She had a baby. But and so then I told the guys, I mean, in the studio, I told the guys I was going to have to leave. I played a couple, I think I played like 3 CD release shows that they scheduled for Celestial Completion. And then I had to step back, stay home, because at the time I didn't have any sort of career plans. I was working at Domino's Pizza. Mm-hmm. So I went back to college, got a degree, became a teacher, and then we had a baby. And so I...
Whoa, don't gloss over that. Ran to college real quick, got a degree to become a teacher, and then had a baby. What kind of degree? What did you teach?
I got a bachelor's degree in history from a little college in the Georgia Mountains called Truett McConnell College. Then I went and got a master's degree in Christian ministry.
Wow.
From Liberty University, online, because they have a really awesome and affordable online program. Woohoo!
You paid for with your golf scholarship, right?
That's right, with my golf scholarship and that sweet Becoming the Archetype moolah. you know, that massive, you know, 4-figure income.
I know what it's like. I'm sitting on a gold throne right now that I bought with the crutch money you referred to earlier.
Awesome. So.
Yeah, man, yeah. Christian metal is definitely where it's at if you want to make money. That's a lucrative career.
Yeah, yeah, there are some bands making some money, but we won't get into that. But anyway, so then I got a job teaching Bible at a private Christian school, teaching the Bible. So I had always loved reading and studying theology and defending the faith and all those kinds of things, and so it was a perfect fit. I got a job teaching. At first I was teaching middle school, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade Bible, which was kind of fun because they're young. Especially the 6th graders, they don't care. Like, they haven't developed the filter yet to like think that they have to be right about everything, and they're not worried what everyone thinks about them. By the time they get to 8th grade, they're kind of turds. But you know, the 6th graders were awesome. They would come in the first day of school and I'd be like, "All right, I'm your Bible teacher. You got any questions?" And they'd be like, "Hey, how do we know God's real?" You know, and I'm like, "Awesome. Let's talk. You know, this is gonna be a cool class. This is gonna be a cool class.
Right.
We're just gonna talk." Me ask the 8th graders like, "Hey, you guys got any questions?" And they're like, "Shut up."
Yeah.
So then I got
my twins. I have boy-girl twins, and they're in 7th grade right now. They're right between still sort of listening to me and becoming turds. So
yeah, exactly.
With you.
7th grade's a transition, but...
it's all over.
Yeah, 8th grade, and then well, they start to come back about 9th or 10th grade. Don't you worry.
Yeah, because they want my car.
Yeah, that's true.
I want a little more. Right, exactly.
But, so then I did that for, I guess, 5 years. Which was awesome. I enjoyed it, but I just this is where it's going to get a little. This is going to become a little bit of a serious story. But I kind of got to a place where I was experiencing some depression and some just really didn't know how I felt about everything, because I still love music, and I still kind of felt like I had one foot in that culture, in that scene, and, you know, there were people talking to me all the time, like, oh, hey, man, I'm still getting emails from people who listen to the band, and I just was really struggling with how that fit in, my background in the music industry, how that fit in with who I was now. I was a theology degree, teaching the Bible. What am I going to do? Am I going to be a pastor? Am I going to be teach at a seminary? Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things, which I wasn't interested in. I didn't want to do that. People be like, well, you don't go become a pastor for the money. But like, the only reason I would have become a pastor would be to get the money, because I didn't want to be a pastor. It was like, you know what I'm saying? So it was like, I wasn't looking for that, and I really struggled with that. So there was a period there where I actually really was kind of depressed, because I was like, man, I guess I just have to leave all of that behind me, like what I used to do with music and my background. I guess that was all just me being a stupid kid and, you know, all the stuff you hear people say. And that was when I was immature. And parentheses into the middle of this is when I got an email from Alex Kinnis. Who I didn't even know was still alive, because I hadn't heard from him for 7 years at that point.
He tends to disappear for most of a decade at a time.
Right. I had not heard from him in 6 or 7 years. He says, hey, I got 10 songs that I'm working on. It's just sort of like a death metal, melodic metal thing. I think would you like to do vocals on it? I was like, well, I don't know if I've got time. I'm a teacher now. I've got a kid. I don't know, man. And
let me guess, he said Travis Turner's on drums, and you were like, I'm in.
He was like, man, Travis Turner's playing drums. I was like, dude, you mean like the crutch guy? And I was like, I gotta get in.
You're so full of shit. Shut up, man.
I gotta get in on this, man. So I said, just send the tracks over. I'll see if I like them, and we'll see if anything comes up. And man, I had 10 songs worth of lyrics in a week that just kind of came. It was really a cool thing, and I was just super excited. I had more fun recording that record than I did probably any BTA record.
Oh my god, that sounds so nice to hear. That's awesome.
And it's not because I didn't love doing the BTA records. I absolutely did. I mean, you heard me rave about the Devin Townsend thing. The thing was, this was some random oddball project with no expectations. I wasn't in a band anymore. Who cares what this sounds like? Who cares if anyone likes it? You know what I mean? It was like, we crowdfunded the money because people thought we were cool enough to trust to do something.
We crowdfunded $6,000, dude.
Yeah, I know. That's more money than, that's more money than I ever made doing, like, delivering pizzas. So,
right.
Anyway, my point is, it was just fun because when I had these songs, it was like, blank slate, what am I going to do? I can do anything. So there's, if you listen to the record, it's a wacky record as far as, some songs, the vocals are, crazy screaming and growling. Some songs are like, it's weird, like opera singing that I just decided sounded cool with that song. And that was so much fun to do.
Yeah, not yet. And I remember you and I, we didn't talk on the phone very many times, but oh my God, 10,000 emails went around. Oh, yeah. And I remember you saying how you're going to experiment with vocals.
Which is hilarious because Alex emailed me with the express purpose of saying, okay, I don't want any singing or anything on this record. This is just going to be a straight up like thrash, like old school, just, brutal metal thrashy kind of record. And I got the stuff and I was just like, well, you know what, let's just record it, John, and just see what happens. Recording with John, who used to play in BTA, and we recorded it in John's house, like in his guest bedroom. I mean, it was just fun.
It was funny videos too. You had something about you had a casserole, you had a casserole in the front seat next to you, and there was something about an ice wizard or something. Dude, your video was hilarious. I loved it.
Yeah, that was Alex. The edits were great. but anyway, I mean, that's the fun part. But here's the, and this is the bombshell. You don't know this. Alex doesn't know this unless you've listened to me say this on another podcast somewhere. I really, if you were to go back in my Facebook, like social media timeline, to when we released the Solomors album, you'll see that I kind of disappeared, which is weird because the album just came out. That's the time we really need to hit it hard and tell everybody about it. But at that time, see, this is where it all fits in with what was going on in my life. At that time, I was also still, like, I was confused about what I was going to do for a living. And I was applying for youth pastor-type jobs and teacher jobs and stuff. Didn't know exactly what I was going to do. And I was scared. I was, like, legitimately afraid that if I was really pumping the Solomors thing hard on social media, that would be the first thing people would find when they got my resume, and they would freak out and not, like, because I was basically worried that the reason I wasn't getting callbacks was because of my past playing metal. Okay, so it's not like I didn't say anything about Solomors. I mean, I did tell people about it and stuff, and I think we did pretty well, but I wasn't pumping it on social media like you probably would have expected, because I was really in a dark place where I felt like conflicted, like, can I still be this guy? I mean, I had a blast recording this record. I love this, but maybe I need to hide this side of me because out of that is where we get to where I am now, which is, and I'm not this. I mean, I'm a good Southern Baptist conservative Christian upbringing kind of guy. So I'm not one of these. And I'm not trying to make it sound like this is bad. I'm just trying to say, so you know where I'm coming from. I don't walk around telling people all the time, like, man, just God spoke to me last night, and he told me, you know, like, I don't talk like that typically, and I don't wake up every night after having these amazing, miraculous dreams of visions that God's given me. That just doesn't happen with me. So one night I had a dream, and in this dream I was at a music festival, and I was helping people learn how to minister to bands. And I woke up and I was like, man, what is that all about? And it was from that I reached out to RIFO, which I'll tell you more about in a minute. But RIFO is this organization that really helped us out when we were on the road. And I was like, hey, could you guys use somebody who, you know, has this background in music but also loves theology, loves discipleship, loves, you know, has a teaching sort of bent to them, but knows music, knows the industry, knows bands, loves bands, that kind of thing. And they were like, that's exactly what we're looking for. We need somebody like that to really take our ministry to the next level. And I was just, it was just such an awesome sort of like weight that came off my shoulders. Like, wait a second, can I do this? Like, is this a real thing that I could do for a job? Like, I could go minister to the music industry and to musicians and, So
this is literally, I mean, pardon the pun, yeah, this is a dream job.
Yeah, it really was. And
use that term loosely, because I've never dreamt about what I do for a living, and, you know, but this kind of came to you, and you thought of the idea before you knew it existed, figured out who to ask, and they were like, yep, you're a perfect fit. Get out of here, really?
Which is funny, because I only vaguely knew who to reach out to, and I had this in my mind. I was like, okay, I think the guy who runs RIFO, his name is Nick Greenwood. And I was like, yeah, Nick Greenwood. Isn't he plays in Overcome, the band Overcome.
Oh, and
so I,
okay.
So, well, no, that's not the whole story. So I reach out to Nick Greenwood on Facebook, and it turns out he doesn't have anything to do. Nick Greenwood from Overcome doesn't have anything to do with RIFO.
And I took the bait. Alright, got me.
Yeah, it's another guy named Nick Greenwood, though, runs RIFO. So I had my wires crossed, but I found him on Facebook. We started talking.
That came back to you because of the Jason Wisdom at whatever, and the dude from New York who had to cut your lawn. That guy. It all came full circle now.
Yeah. Exactly right. So yeah, no, it was a dream thing. And it's definitely a, you know, it's an exciting thing. I feel more at this point. I feel more like I'm doing what I need to be, what I'm supposed to be doing, what God has sort of built into my life, my background, from my experience and everything. I'm excited about it. I mean, it's not to say that It's not to say that, you know, everybody wouldn't be excited about being able to do the thing that they want to do, you know, but it's just, it all came together in such a cool way. And like I said, I mean, now my job now working with RIFO is to reach out to musicians and minister to their needs as they're on the road, as they're disconnected from home life and, you know, all those different sorts of things, which I'm passionate about because I was married and I went on tour to go to Cornerstone like the week after we got back from our honeymoon, and it totally jacked up our, you know, our relationship as a new married couple. And sure. So there are couples out there that need, you know what I mean? They need help. There's these tour widows that are out there, wives of these people that are on tour, and they feel like they're abandoned. You know, who's ministering to those people? But then who's going on the road with the bands and helping them out, and, you know, being with them? Who's providing places for them to stay, giving them food to eat, you know, taking care of them when they're on the road? And so now that's what I get to do as my job, and it's awesome. It's awesome. Okay. It's also,
before it's we also get scary. Further, yeah. Before we get much further into it, you're doing a really good job ramping up as to explaining how important this is to you.
Yeah.
Circle back. What is it? What's right? What does it stand for? Who, you, like let's drop the link in here, you know?
Okay. So yeah. So, so RIFO, RYFO stands for Rock Your Face Off, which is just, I mean, you know, there have been some really good college dorm room ideas that went on to make millions of dollars. This probably won't make millions, but, But it's a great idea. Rock your face off. Hey, what if we had a ministry that, like, reached out to musicians? And here we are. I guess it's been about 7 or 8 years since they formed RIFO.
Really?
We found out about RIFO when we were at Cornerstone, and we heard about it. And what we heard was, hey, you need places to stay where you can sleep in a bed and get a shower, we'll do your laundry, get some hot food. And we were like, what, for free? And they were like, yeah, that's totally what we do. We have a network around the country of homes, and all you got to do is sign up for our network, and it's all free. And you can go stay with people. They'll open up their house. You can come stay in the basement. You can come stay, you know, whatever, hang out with them, all that kind of stuff.
It's like a couch surfing network for bands.
It was like a couch surfing network for bands, and we were like, oh, sweet, let's do that. We signed up for that, and it was awesome. It totally revolutionized the way we toured, because now it was like that whole aspect to where now we would book our tours and we knew where we were going to stay. We knew the people we were going to see, and that was really the best part about it, was the people. It wasn't that we had a place to stay, because a lot of bands have places to stay. They could get a hotel, or they sleep in their van or whatever. It's right. Or sleep in their tour bus. To me, at least, the best part was, hey, we know we're going to go see these people. Every time we go to this city, we're going to stay with these people because they have a host home there. Every time we go to these people. So we actually developed really like family relationships with some of these people. We would sit up late into the night talking to them and hanging out and stuff like that. It was awesome. So
now here's something I spoke about with Andrew from Torch. I'm not just name dropping, but yeah, we did have this conversation. Part of the problem with that is becoming the archetype has to spend the night somewhere 7 nights a week.
Right.
And you have a tour of 60 dates, right?
Right.
But this is the one time I've seen Becoming the Archetype in the past 4 years, and now they're coming to my house to sleep. I want to stay up all night and party with these guys. Let's get pizza. Let's watch movies. Let's be best friends. Whee! Right. Like, I got to go to bed. I'm in a band, and I do this for a living, and we have to climb in the van and drive 9 states tomorrow. Like, with all due respect, thanks for the bed. Shut up. I need to go to sleep. How do you balance that?
Yeah, that's the nice part about the way we do the network. We understand that because pretty much everybody who works for RIFO, including myself, has a background in a band. So we know that, like, while it's awesome to have the opportunity, if you want to sit up and talk with the people and hang out with them, you really don't want a bunch of people fangirling all over you the whole time and stuff like that, because that's going to totally defeat the purpose. So we don't advertise the bands that we have in our network. We probably could get a much bigger network if we told people, the bands that had signed up, some of the big bands, hey, they could come stay at your house, but we don't do that because we don't want people fangirling out over them and stuff, and we don't want people, we tell all the host homes when they first sign up, like, you know, sometimes these bands are just going to roll in, it'll be 2 a.m., they're just going to need a door that's open. They're going to roll in. They're going to take like a 4-hour nap, and they're going to get back on the road and go. They don't necessarily have time to come in and hang out and smoke a cigar with you. Maybe they do, maybe they don't, you know. If they do, that's awesome. Be available. Do that with them. If not, just, you know, be there to provide, you know, the service for them. And so Rifo, I think, has a better handle on that. Like, if the guy you're talking about from Torch, I mean, if he were to be a part of our organization, a part of our meetings, I'm sure he would, that'd be one of the first things he'd say is, okay, like, the host home idea is cool, but a lot of times it sucks because X, Y, and Z. Well, right. That's a lot of what I can bring to the table and the other guys can bring to the table. It's like, okay, host homes are cool, but they kind of suck because, you know, or the idea of having, you know, Christians ministering to bands. Well, that sounds almost like dirty because, you know, it reminds you of like a pastor guy going to the show with like a Bible and trying to pass it out to the bands and be like, here you go, you heathens, let's get saved, you know. So we can approach it differently because we understand it. So that's where I come into the picture is they've already got this host home network set up of like host homes in about 30 states and growing, always looking for more. We got about 600 plus bands in the network, always growing. We were at Warped Tour last year and this year, and hope to have an increased presence at Warped Tour in future years.
I had no idea, dude.
Yeah, so we've been getting more and more bands signing up, especially more and more bands who aren't Christian bands, because that's where we started. We are a Christian nonprofit organization. So we started out at like Cornerstone festivals and places like that, but now we're spreading out more and getting more atheistic bands and just, you know, general, you know what I mean? Like we have a lot more bands in the network and everybody's welcome. There are certain expectations. You can't roll into somebody's basement with like a kegger and just like, you know, tear the place down. This is, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you want to live that lifestyle, you're probably not going to a host home anyway. You're going to the hotel room, but, you know what I mean?
So, thanks for the heroin addicts in my basement, right?
Exactly. But, you know, so I come into the picture. They've got this host home network, and I'm coming in now to really help build out another wing of the ministry, another network, so to speak, to come alongside the host home network, which is where we can put people out on the road with bands who can help them do things like tech their drums, you know, drive their tour buses, do their merch, but also be an influence, you know, a positive influence for Christ, because we are a ministry and that's what we do. We want people to, you know, to grow closer to Jesus. And and so on the one hand, we'll have people who can just provide services for secular bands and do stuff like that. And then we'll have people who, if there's a Christian band and they want somebody to come on the road and do Bible studies, awesome. We got that too. But then also, what if people don't want somebody to go on the road with them? Because that's another thing. See, as somebody who's been in a band, sometimes you don't want another dude in the van. You're like, forget that. We don't want.
Matter of fact, you want less dudes in the band. Right. They already have to be there, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So what if that doesn't work for the band? Okay. Well, what if we just have people entrenched in the local scene who are going to shows, really have a heart for bands, want to take them out to eat, talk to them, hang out with them, have conversations, take care of them, you know, and every time you go to that town, and if a person's listening to this and they've toured a lot, they know that these people naturally kind of occur. They're out there. You'll see these people like, oh yeah, man, every time we go to such and such town, we see this person and he takes us out for barbecue, or every time we go to that town, you know, and so these relationships are what we want to, you know, sort of capitalize on in this, you know, mentor type relationship that bands can reconnect with people. Because as like I was saying earlier with, I think this part got in there earlier about the difficulty of relationships when you're on the road, the relationships you leave behind with wives and people like that. I mean, one of the things you really need to be healthy mentally, spiritually, physically on the road is you need people to sort of anchor you back into reality. You need people you can hang out with, people you can see, people you can have talk with, because the guys in the band don't cut it after a while. Sure. And the people at the shows don't cut it, because people might think, oh, well, you're on the road. Everybody loves you, right? You get on the stage, and it's awesome, and everybody's cheering your name. They all think you're great, you know, but that, you know, the lights cut off, and you got to go back to the tour bus with a bunch of smelly guys, and you're all wiped out because you just loaded your gear off, and the wheels are breaking off of your cabinets, and they don't work anymore, and the drummer takes 10 hours to get his stuff broken down and put in the van. listen, I had the unique perspective on that of being the vocalist, but also the bass player. So whereas most vocalists would kind of be like, you know, hey man, when are you going to get your drums off stage? You know,
vocalists are usually, with all due respect to them, vocalists are usually the ones who run straight back to the table because they're the figurehead of the band usually. And they're the ones that I think most of the people want to talk to usually. And it's the easiest for them to run their ass over to the table and grab the merch money and start slinging stickers and t-shirts. Because the drummer is like, I'm busy for the next half an hour. I have to put all these tubs in the van, you know.
Right, which is what I did a lot of the nights. But I always, I guess what I'm saying is, I had the unique perspective. I still had gear to unload.
Right.
So I didn't, you know, I was a little bit of a turd sometimes, probably to Duck or to whoever was taking longer to get set up, or sometimes I was in a bad mood because I had to go set up the merch while everybody else was doing other stuff, and I'm like, well, has anybody ever helped me? But I was also, but and you know this about me, other people don't. But I'm also kind of OCD with stuff, so I wanted the merch to be set up a certain way, so it didn't make me mad that nobody was helping me. I wanted it my way. It's the same way with, like, when we were driving the van, I always wanted to drive because I didn't like the way anybody else would drive. So bringing all that back, like, you know, my role with RIFO is to help them, you know, really flesh out this model of how do we meet the needs of bands, you know, physical needs, but also spiritual needs. How do we reach the bands that are out there that are completely disconnected from everything, from family life, from church life, from friends, from all the stuff that we all kind of take for granted. And we tend to think, oh, but, you know, they're on the road doing what they, you know, that's what they've always wanted to do. And, you know, we should all envy them. And to a certain extent, I can see that because I loved it.
It's an illusion.
But if you've ever...
That's what Stick said. It's a grand illusion.
Yeah, but if you've ever lived it and you've ever been out there, it can be an incredibly lonely, incredibly dark place, which is why so many musicians, you know, struggle with the things they do with depression.
Yeah, that's where all the vices come in. Yeah, I just to use myself as an example, not that I'm trying to talk about myself, but I mean, I'm an exterminator, right? I kill bugs for a living.
That's metal. So, that's brutal.
How metal is that? I kill God's creation. Yeah, I love it. With chemicals. It's like chemical warfare, man.
Yeah.
But I am supposed to be home by a certain time, and somebody calls in with a hornet's nest. I have to go because that's a stinging insect that's going to hurt somebody.
Right.
So I have to go take care of that. I now have to text my wife and be like, hey, I'm going to be an hour later than I thought I was. The ripple effect, the friggin' pebble that I threw into that lake. Oh, God, I thought you were going to be able to pick up our daughter, and I got dinner by then. I have to go to work tonight. La, 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 la. Now I got to move the kids up to the in-laws and everything. That's just me saying I'm going to be in 90 minutes late.
Right.
These musicians are leaving for 60 days.
Right.
Have fun with the kid, and by the way, I'll probably send home no money.
Right.
Bye.
I'm getting $5 a day to eat on.
Right.
And
right.
They're going to give us a hot and ready pizza when we get to the, you know. And so, so that to me is the value. It was the value to me when I was on the road of RIFO was these sort of reconnection points with people. And, I mean, and you know, you weren't part of the RIFO network, but you had that role as a friend of ours.
Yeah.
That, you know, when we would come through and we'd play Crocodile Rock or something like that, we would know, hey, we're going to see Travis, we're going to hang out, we'll probably go eat breakfast at a diner or something. And, you know, I, like the guy from Torch said, no, it's not always possible. Sometimes you got to drive 15 hours the next day.
Right.
You can't do that. But sometimes you can, and when you can, it's awesome. And we loved it, and we learned about pierogies. I had my first pierogies at that diner with you. What was that diner?
The Trivet.
Yeah. I had pierogies for the first time, which I love pierogies now.
All right.
So there you go, man. I mean, so those kinds of things are valuable, and that's really what RIFO, you know, wants to capitalize on and bring to bands. So I'm excited about it. I'm thrilled to be doing it.
We don't have a lot of listeners on this podcast. I always say with modest, humble beginnings, but the people who listen to this podcast, email me, tweet me. They're probably Facebooking Steven. Steven's in charge of the Facebook page. I don't do Facebook, but people are reaching out and having intimate conversations with us about how this is awesome. I love this. This is cool that you're involved with this. This is the type of thing that I think you're actually, I know you didn't come on here to advertise or throw up a RIFO commercial, but I think you're speaking to the right crowd. I definitely think people are going to click on a link for this. I think people are going to be, interested in this. And by the way, listeners, and spread this around. If there's more of a community out there,
yeah,
it's cheaper for bands to be on the road. more kick-ass shows in your town. Am That's I right? right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Because becoming the archetype, the one night you guys, I forget what the situation was, but you guys couldn't spend the night at my house. Brandon was with you. It was a dichotomy tour.
Right.
And that's the day that's when I met Brandon, who is still got to be one of the funniest dudes I ever met. And you guys stayed at the at the motel next to the Trivet. I met you at the Trivet.
Right.
And then I kind of became like your road manager for the day. And then after the show, you guys drove to another town and spent the night there because right. that's what made sense for your agenda. So something like you were getting in like 3 a.m. and I was like, dude, I got to work. I can't have you coming to my house 3 a.m. and interrupting everything. So that cost you guys the hotel room, the extra gas of running around, blah, right. blah, blah, blah. That motel room was a dump, but I mean, it still had to cost you a certain amount of money. If RIFO was there to say, go around the back of this house and go and let yourself in, you can sleep there, you just save that band.
$1,500, you know? I mean, yeah. that's the money. A lot of times these bands that a lot of people don't realize, they don't realize the money situation for those bands. It's not to whine or anything like that. I mean, but they just don't. A lot of them don't realize. A lot of these bands are rolling into a town. They're playing for 100 to 200 people. Sometimes they're playing for 50 people. You know, sometimes the guy who booked the show is giving them like $100. That barely covers. Yeah, it probably doesn't even cover their gas money. Sometimes, right. you know, and then they got to go stay somewhere. So it really does. It does. To a certain extent, it really does bolster the community, the music community, when there are these services provided to people, when RIFO can have people that can give them food too. Right. I mean, as cool as it is to, you know, to go to Denny's every night and, you know, gain 1,000 pounds when you're on the road, and, you know what I mean? And as cool as that is,
lay off the pierogies, lard ass.
Yeah. As cool as that is, it's really nice to be able to be like, hey, we're going to roll into this person's house and they're going to have breakfast for us in the morning. We don't have to spend money on that.
Right.
You know, six guys on the road who've all got to pay, you know, $4 or $5 for breakfast. You learn really quickly how to get cheap food, but that cheap food's usually awful for you. So it all feeds back into the general health of the community. And if other things like this, if I'm one of the things I really want to help us build out with RIFO, like I was mentioning earlier, is a ministry to wives and to couples who are struggling, bands that are out on the road. Well, if we can figure out a way to help them get their marriage back on track, help things work out, you know what I mean? Like, these are ways to make people on the road healthier so they can keep doing it longer. All of that goes back into it. So if you go to rifo.org, that's the link that you can drop in for people. But, I mean, there are lots of opportunities that people can help out. They can sign up to become a host home. They can, email us about, hey, I'd like to become, possibly be a person who can be a chaplain out on the road with bands, or I'd like to just, you know, help some bands out. Hey, if they come through my town, I can change their oil or something for free. You know, those kinds of things. We can always use those kinds of things. And of course, there are ways to donate money because we're a nonprofit organization, and we don't have money if people don't donate it. So there's that. But it's an organization that meant a lot to me, and I'm super, super thrilled to be. It's my job now. So.
This is super cool. I'm going to put rifo.org in the show notes. I'm going to put up links for real quick. Why don't you tell us about your blog?
Yeah, I have a website, becauseitstrue.com, where I write articles and answer questions and make videos and stuff like that. It's an apologetics is the big fancy, theological word for it.
What does that mean?
Apologetics. Yeah, apologetics essentially just means defending the faith or giving an answer. The word apologia in the Greek means to give a reason. And, you know, so apologetics is providing reasons. Why do we believe what we believe? And my website is because it's true. That's why I believe. So a lot of people have sort of the misconception that Christianity is a, faith equals no reason. Like, it's the opposite of reason. Like, if you have faith, then that means that there's no reasons. Or if you, right. You know, you're just supposed to believe because you believe.
Yeah, and I don't have to justify why. I just do.
And yeah, you're I just wrong. Do.
And who wants to sign up for that? That sounds crazy.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that's become kind of the modern day norm of what the word faith or belief equals. It's like faith equals you don't have any reasons, or belief means, oh, it's not really true, you just believe it anyway.
Right.
When that's not the biblical use of those words, that's not the traditional Christian understanding. It's also just not the way we use those words typically in language. I mean, if you say, if you go off somewhere, you go to work every day, and you say, look, I have faith that my wife's not sleeping around on me. You don't say that because you have no reasons. You say, well, it's because I know my wife and we have a history together, and I've got good reasons to think she's not sleeping around on me. You put trust in her. That's what you mean when you say faith. But for some reason nowadays, when people say faith, a lot of times they're equating it with, oh, faith means you don't have any reasons. So my website is my website's there to be a, you know, hey, look, I'm a guy who likes to think about stuff. I'm skeptical about a lot of things, which I'm sure a lot of people who listen to this podcast probably are. I mean, you know, thinkers, that's another thing people don't understand. A lot of musicians, a lot of creative types are very thoughtful, introspective people, especially the ones that listen to metal and stuff. A lot of people write them off as like, oh, you know, those guys, they just scream and yell, and it's just all, you know what I mean? But they don't understand that culture, that culture has a whole, like, it's got a whole richness to, like, you know, being tied into philosophy and literature and all this other kind of stuff, in ways that pop music and, you know, country music often don't have anything to do with that kind of stuff. It's just real surface level. I got my truck and my dog and my girl with the short pants on. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And,
I have a close friend of mine who, like, isn't into music. I love the guy. He and I have a commonality when it comes to sports and cooking on the back grill and that kind of thing. He lives on my street. And, He overhears some of the music that I'm involved with, and he starts headbanging. You know how people who don't headbang do that fake headbang where it looks like their neck already hurts?
Yeah.
And he does the devil horns, but he does it wrong. He makes the I love you sign, and he goes, kill your mother, kill your father. And I was like, stop right there. Nothing in my life has ever – those words have never – stop it. You have no idea what you're talking about. He's like, oh, no, I know. You're a good dude. But it's just funny. The people just think, like, oh, you listen to heavy music and the guy is screaming. Instantly, they're just ripping the heads off puppies. Right? It's like, dude, no. What are you talking about? Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Lived it my whole life.
Yeah. So, I mean, my website's just dedicated to parsing through those issues. People send me questions. I haven't been able. We just had the birth. I haven't mentioned this yet. We just had the birth of our second child, a new little girl, 2 months ago, 2.5 months ago. So we have...
What are your kids' names?
Oh, I have Noah.
Noah?
Noah, who's 3.5, and we have Shelby, who is now 2.5 months old.
Shelby.
So Noah and Shelby, yep. So they're awesome, and Noah loves his baby sister. He's just 3.5, and so he doesn't know how to not be rough with her. So he likes to slap her and poke her in the eyes and, you know, like... Like, this is how we play, right? Let's wrestle. She's a newborn. She doesn't do that. But so I haven't been able to post a lot of stuff on my website. But I've got hundreds of articles and hundreds of things there. Everything from stuff that's going on in popular culture to stuff that's just like really weird, deep theological questions that I've been pondering about, like, if we say God is everywhere, does that mean God's in hell? You know, well, I got an article on that where I talk about that. Just interesting questions. So,
I think most of the listening crowd of this podcast would be interested in something like that. Hit me again,
becauseitstrue.com.
Okay.
And if they're, I mean, from becauseitstrue.com, if they're interested in supporting my personal, you know, ministry fund that I'm raising money for, there's a link there that they can donate and stuff to the work I'm doing. So, yeah.
Give us a crazy story. A quick, something that a Becoming the Archetype fan is going to go, oh, that is awesome at the end of it. Tell us something nuts from the road. And if you need help, I texted Alex.
Oh, no. Yeah. I don't need help.
Okay, shoot.
Well, I would love to hear what Alex has got, but a crazy story from the road.
He said something about printing your own t-shirts on the road from a craft store.
Okay, that did happen, which was awesome. On the Demon Hunter tour, we had the kind of problem that every band would love to have, which is we sold out of merch.
Oh, right on. Yeah, but now what do you do tomorrow?
Now what do we do? Because people are buying merch like crazy.
Right.
And we want to make money, so we go to a Michael's or whatever it was, a craft store, and we bought a bunch of black t-shirts, and we got some like spray paint and some craft paint, like pins. And we just spray-painted BTA with some stencils on a bunch of shirts, and then all autographed them with the little felt, you know, the little paint pins. That's pretty cool. We had to have sold, I don't know, a couple hundred of those shirts. Some guy posted a picture the other day on Facebook of, hey, look, I still got this shirt. And I was like, oh, my gosh, you can't believe that. That's awesome. So that's a crazy story. Let me tell you a crazier one.
Hit. Go.
Okay. So we are – this is – I guess maybe a year or two before I left the band, we're up in Baltimore, Maryland area, and okay. we're sitting dead still in traffic, not going anywhere. And we're just all, it's you know, we've been driving for hours and hours. We're all tired. We're all loopy. We're at the point where everything's funny. You know, you go through that point where everything's irritating. Yeah. After you get past the point where everything's irritating, you get to the point where everything's funny.
Right.
And so now everything's funny, and Daniel, who was playing guitar for us at the time, little guy, I mean, he's, you know, 100 pounds soaking wet,
right.
Wraps himself up in his sleeping bag, and he, like, flops over into the front bench seat behind the driver's seat, and he's, like, rolling around in the seat like he's a worm or something, and, you know, and just goofing off, and we're laughing about it. And I said, Seth is sitting in the passenger seat. I'm driving. I said, Seth, dude, this would be hilarious. What if you grab Daniel, throw him on your shoulder, you run up to the van in front of us. Okay, so we're touring with another band, and they're up at Onward to Olympus, I think, was the band.
Okay.
They're ahead of us, one van. We're sitting dead still. Nobody's moving. I'm like, throw Daniel on your shoulder, run up to their van, open the door, toss Daniel in, and Daniel, just go buck wild. Just start screaming and losing your mind, wiggling around, kicking, you know, who cares? Knock some teeth out, whatever. Wouldn't it be hilarious? And we just thought this would be hysterical. And we're all so loopy that we're like, okay, let's do it. So Seth gets out of the car, opens up the door, gets Daniel up on his shoulder, and then traffic starts moving. Like, exactly at that moment, traffic starts moving. So unconsciously, I let my foot off the brake pedal, you know? I mean, it's just you kind of do that. And so the car kind of lurches forward. Seth almost drops Daniel. He kind of pushes him back up into the car, and we get on the road. So nothing happens. Okay. But I look at Seth, and I'm like, dude, that probably didn't look really good. Like, I wonder what people thought. So we get to a part in the road where we're kind of a new lane merges in, and people start passing us, and they're driving past us like 2 miles an hour, but you can see them craning their necks looking into our van, like, what's going on in there?
Oh, no.
And I was like, oh, my gosh, these people are staring at us. So we get just another mile or whatever down the road, and there's two state troopers parked on the left side of the road. And it's like, okay, those are here for us. There's no question they're here for us. So we get past them, and the lights come on instantly. I mean, we pull over. We're only going like 2 miles an hour. It's no big deal.
Yeah, we're going to go, right?
Yeah, we pull over. The band in front of us, Onward to Olympus, I guess they didn't know what's going on, so they pull over also. So, you know, we're pulled over. And I can't tell this part the way the other guys tell it because they experienced it. But apparently, in a really calm, quiet voice from the driver's seat, I said, they've got their guns out. About the police officers, they've got their guns out. And all of a sudden we hear, they're slamming on the side of the van saying, get out of the car! Get out of the car! Where's the girl? Where's the girl? And they've got their guns pointed at us. And as soon as I hop down out of the driver's seat, there's a gun pointed straight at my head. And the guy says, get on the ground or I'll blow your effing head off. Okay, I hit the ground seconds, I mean, just instantly hit the ground. I'm on the left side of the road where there's grass that's like 4 feet tall. And I'm buried in my face in the grass over here. The other guys get the benefit of getting out on the right side. They're kind of sitting in the shoulder on the concrete. And they're screaming, where's the girl? Where's the girl? Somebody had called and told them that we were kidnapping a girl in a sleeping bag, and she was trying to escape, and we were pushing her back into the car. And that's the story that the police heard, so they were going crazy on us. Well, Seth and Daniel and them are over there on the other side explaining this to the police officers, and eventually they get to stand up, and they like forget about me over there, like buried in the grass up to my eyeballs. And eventually they come over, they're like, oh, hey, you know, we explained it to the police officers, and everybody's laughing about it.
Sorry!
everybody's cutting up about it. So that is the craziest road story I have, when I had a gun pointed directly at my head, and I had someone legitimately for real threaten to blow my head off.
I think that's the craziest story I've ever heard.
So kids, don't play pranks when you're on the road. That's the rule. That's the moral of the story.
How'd that make Daniel feel, that everybody saw him in a sleeping bag and they assumed he was a girl?
Well, that's what I'm saying. You know, he's like 100 pounds, yeah. You know, 5'2" or something, and there's no way that he's probably 5'5", but I don't want him listening to this and being like, I'm not 5'2". but you know what I mean?
Right.
I guess they just assumed, hey, somebody small, you know, they're not probably kidnapping a grown man.
God, that's insane. So, okay, what's the other band called?
They were called Onward to Olympus. They're not around. They're not around anymore. But they were.
They were there that night. So when you all got to the next venue,
the police went up to their van and were checking for the girl too, but they didn't make them get out of the car.
I see.
So they were just kind of asking them, hey, do you know anything about a girl? So it was actually kind of helpful that they were there, because they were kind of able to vouch for us, I guess. That we were just a band on the road. We weren't doing anything. We were just goofing off in traffic. And the fun, you know, of all of that, that's really funny.
You just won this category. I don't know who am I going to talk to that's going to top a story like that.
Well, so right after all this happens, this to me is one of the funniest little kickers of it, just for me.
Okay.
So the two police officers who are there with us, they just start cutting up. I mean, they're joking around. You know, they're pulling up our songs on YouTube on their phones and stuff like that. They're goofing off, and they're like, hey, you guys are funny, but don't do that again. Well, another trooper rolls up, like, as this is going on, and these guys, which this is the funniest part to me, because I've never heard police officers talk this way. I'm sure they do, like anybody does, about another police officer. So they go, oh, don't listen to this guy. He's a tool bag. And so this state trooper gets out, and he's got like the full, like the big brimmed hat on and the big like aviator sunglasses. And you can tell this guy takes himself way too seriously. And they were just like, don't listen to anything he says. And he comes over and he's like, what seems to be the problem here, fellas? And I mean, they all just start, the police officer, the two guys just start cracking up, and we can't help, you know what I mean? So that to me is one of the funniest parts about it, is like, now we're on the side of the interstate after we just thought we were going to get killed, and now the police officer cutting up and putting, you know, making fun of this other police officer guy who takes himself way too seriously, you know, within a matter of like 20 minutes. So,
wow, I'm really glad you didn't resist arrest. That would have been bad.
Yep.
Jeez, Jason, thanks for your time, man. I really appreciate it. Let your family have the internet back, and awesome. Thanks so much.
Was that you think that'd be a good one? A good interview?
I think so.
Awesome.
I hope so. If not, too bad. I'm putting it up anyway. Lapse of time. Synchro free.
We love you. Take care. Bye-bye.